Revelation 6, we'll start with, again, verses 10 through 12. We read these verses last week, but did not completely talk about everything that we find in them. And they cried with a great voice, saying, "How long, O Master, the holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth?" And there was given them to each one a white robe. And it was said unto them that they should rest for a little time, until their fellow servants also and their brethren, who should be killed, even as they were, should have been fulfilled. Now this is the fifth seal, Revelation chapter 6, verse 9. John sees these souls, these people under the altar. We pointed out from Revelation chapter 8, I believe it's verse 3, that the altar is pictured as being before God. Where we stopped last week was, sometimes when people look at this information, they think or they conclude that these people are in heaven. I understand why people draw that conclusion. I do not, though, think that that is right. We're dealing with a vision. If you'll back up a little bit to verse 8, Revelation chapter 6, we talked about the fact that the seals describe things that are related to Christians, the things that Christians experience. As you look at verse 8, "And I saw and behold a pale horse, and he that sat upon him, his name was" who?
Death.
Death. Do Christians face death? Yes, they do. And behind death was
Hades.
Now, it sure seems to me, if we're talking about Christians, that they are not only affected by death, but they're also affected by Hades. If that's true, that would suggest that when a person dies, where do they go? Not to heaven, but to
Hades,
this holding area. Now, some think that people were held, the righteous were held in the good section of Hades until Jesus came. And after Jesus came and ascended into heaven, the only people who are in Hades now are the wicked people. That, to me, seems to be a difficult conclusion for a lot of reasons, one of which is what John specifically says here. We do know from Luke 16:25, at least when Jesus spoke the words, that Hades, that word describes the realm of the dead. It's like a big circle, which I would draw a line through it. He talks about two sections. There was a section that Lazarus went to. He was comforted there. There was a section that the rich man went to. He was not comforted. He was in a state of torment. Don?
You probably just answered the question, but I thought you said that only Christians.
No, it's that general realm of the dead, but there's that division there. But some think that after Jesus went back to heaven, Hades was emptied out as far as the righteous.
The godly and ungodly face death, they face Hades.
That's my understanding of it, yes, and the point that I would make. So we've got that information. Jesus, in Luke 23, verse 43, remember the thief that was on the cross with him? The thief that was penitent there at the end, Jesus said, "Today you're going to be with me in
paradise.
Well, we know from Acts 2, Peter's sermon, he says Jesus descended into Hades after his death. King James says hell, but it actually, the right word there is Hades. So Jesus went to the Hadean realm with the thief. Acts 2, Luke 23:43 describes this as paradise. When we look at some other passages, one of them that comes to my mind is Philippians 1, verse 23. Paul said to the Philippians, "My desire is to depart," that is to die, "and to be with Christ." Now, I'm not sure exactly what all is involved in the positive side of the Hadean realm. But from Philippians 1:23, it does seem to me that whatever happens there, it allows people to have a relationship with Christ, with God, that exceeds what they have in this life. So we're just not given a lot of information. The other thing that I think, well, two more things that seem to me to be important. Remember the picture back in Revelation chapter 5, verses 11 and 12? "And I saw and I heard a voice of many angels round about the throne and the living creatures and the elders, and the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands, saying with a great voice, Worthy is the Lamb that hath been slain to receive the honor, the riches, the wisdom, and might, honor, and glory, and blessing." When we look at the picture here in Revelation chapter 5, does it sound like these folks are kind of like people on earth today, distracted, thinking about, oh, let's see, there's lunch and there's a pile of dishes and I got to mow the yard and there's this project at work? Sounds like they're completely focused on worship and God. But as we look at the people here in Revelation chapter 6, verses 10 through 12, what are they doing? They're crying out with this loud voice. How long? Are they focused on something besides God and worship? They are. So, once again, if they're in heaven, it's a little difficult for me to reconcile how they are so focused on this That is, how long before this gets resolved on the earth when they should be focused on God? Now, if they're in the Hadean realm, that's not difficult for me to understand. If this isn't convincing enough, you still then have to wrestle with this. Let's have somebody go over to the book of John. We've talked about this passage a couple of times in recent months. John chapter 3, verse 13. But it is a passage which helps us in so many different ways. John 3, verse 13. And we'll pay specific attention to the verb tense that John uses. John 3, verse 13. Don's got it. I think I saw his hand first. Thank you.
No one has ascended into heaven except he who descended from heaven, Son of Man.
Okay. No one has gone where? No one has ascended. John uses the perfect tense. Remember with the perfect tense that it describes something that was true in the past and it continues to be true. The force of that would be no one has ever ascended into heaven. In this passage, some might say, well, this was true when Jesus made this statement, but after the resurrection, Hades gets cleaned out and it's no longer the case. To me, I don't know how you can reconcile that with the perfect tense, because John is writing it and he says, no man has ever ascended into heaven, as he records the Lord's words.
Peter said that Jesus went to Hades.
Acts 2,
Was that from the time that he gave up the ghost?
Yes. Right. Remember, James chapter 2 talks about death. It defines it as death being the separation of the body and the spirit. Jesus had that. He commits his spirit to the Father, if you will. The human life force passes. The body dies on the cross. That spirit goes to the Hadean realm, as Peter talks about in Acts 2. And then on the third day, as the body minus the spirit is dead, the flip side of that would be the body plus the spirit is life. So that spirit is returned from the Hadean realm, fused again with the body. He returns to life. So yes. So he was there not actually 72 hours, but parts of 3 days, which the Bible refers to as 3 days. So once again, I don't try to be dogmatic on that, but if we try to look at the evidence, it seems to me as we look at the people in Revelation chapter 6, John sees them before the throne. He's not saying that they are in heaven. Anything that you want to add or ask about that point before we say some more about Revelation 6:10? Okay. Sherman.
Right on verse 8. I probably wasn't here.
Okay.
Is there significance that this is the only horse that the writer was named? And then there was somebody with that writer? Because all the other ones didn't say who.
It specifies. Even with the white horse, it doesn't specifically come out and say that it's Jesus. It helps us. I don't know that there's any special significance to that. It makes it a little easier as far as interpretation. When you think about, for example, the red horse and you've got the slaughter, you wouldn't have to necessarily call that murder. I mean, you could call that the persecution horse. When you think about the famine horse, the black horse, you have imagery there. So it seems to me you come out to the same place, but rather than using the imagery, here you have an emphasis on the name. So basically the same way to get to the same spot, you're getting to the same spot, you're just going at it in a slightly different direction. Sometimes the effects are given, sometimes you have the actual name of the horse. That would be my thinking on that.
There's the name of the rider was on the horse.
Right.
You don't know what the other ones.
Right.
The name of the collar of the horse, but it didn't say it was riding.
Right. Yeah. And you have some other differences as well. If we think about Jesus being on the white horse, we would not, I think, try to associate any specific individual with a black horse or with a red horse. So there are some variations here, and I wouldn't go too far as trying to read too much.
Well, I would have thought on a black horse would have been Satan, not the hell horse.
So, yeah, but he helps us a little bit there. We would, I think, probably be inclined to think that it probably represents evil, maybe mourning, but when he gives us some information about the scales and the barley and so forth, the wheat, it helps us understand what that particular symbol is. Somebody else, I thought, flashed a hand? Okay. In verse 10, Revelation chapter 6, it's an interesting verse for a lot of reasons. One of which is that it seems to suggest that people have, we're talking still about the saved, people seem to have some memory of their life on earth. Do you think the Lord remembers the fact that people crucified him? If he's pictured as the lamb that's been slain, it seems to me that he has a recollection of what took place on the cross. In a similar way, it seems to me that in this case, the Christians who've been martyred, they also have some recollection of how they were unfairly treated. In fact, John specifically says in this vision, these saints cried out, what? How long? They knew that justice had not yet been served. They knew that a time still needed to come before this judging, this avenging of their deaths would take place. As I think about that, it suggests to me that at least for time, and especially if we're dealing with the Hadean realm, people who go to that place may still have some questions. We may have the idea that as soon as we leave this life, all of our questions are going to be answered. It may be that we are in some state of learning throughout eternity. I'm not sure that we could, by the Bible, prove the idea that once we die or once we eventually get to heaven that, you know, God's just going to zap everything into our heads and we're just going to have super knowledge. We're going to know everything that we can possibly know. If God is as great and as vast and as magnificent and as wonderful as he is, it would seem to me that there's going to be throughout eternity some degree of learning. When we look at the angels, remember what Peter said? There were some things as God's plan of salvation was unfolded. There were some things that they desired to look into. So angels have been learning for a long, long time. It would not then surprise me to find that people are also going to be learning about things in eternity. Okay, let's see what else we have here from verse 10. Would you say that these people were in a state of soul sleep? Some have the idea that after death, people who die are in a state of soul sleep. There's no consciousness. These people were very much alive. In fact, they were able actually to reason. They're able to process things. They remember things. So the idea that people die and they have some kind of state where they're just sleeping, that's simply not true. We also see here, and Don mentioned this a couple of minutes ago, there is an eternal spirit that continues after death. As you look at these verses, here again is a place where the verb tense is very important. It says they cried out with this question. Now we might, on the face of it, think of that maybe in terms of a child. A child wants to go, you know, to the fair. All right? You think the child's just going to ask once? Probably not. The child's going to ask and ask and ask until you finally load the child up in the car and take them to the fair. Now, if I were just looking at this text initially, I probably would be inclined to think that this is expressed with a present tense. They cried again and again and again and again. That's not true. The cry here is expressed with an aorist tense verb. This particular tense means that they cried, they asked, if you will, just one time. Now, I find that to be very interesting. They made this request, God gives them an answer, and they don't come back to this particular question. They had an honest request. They wanted to know when God was going to exact justice from these people. Now, this was a good question. It was a thoughtful question, and they certainly were not rebuked for it. They, as we mentioned, realized that they'd been treated unjustly. They had a strong interest in seeing God impose justice on the world in which they lived. They want to know, when is this going to occur? John answers this question. In fact, we can kind of summarize Revelation 7, the next chapter, by this question. When are you going to judge the people who have hurt us, who have taken our lives? Revelation 7 is going to describe this, and that's kind of a whole new ball game for us, but we will talk about that shortly. So as we look at these departed saints, they were able to wonder, they were able to reason, they were able to remember, and they were able to listen. As these departed souls address God, how do they address him? Well, they do address him with a loud voice. Is there a title that they use? Master. All right, Sovereign Lord is also going to give us a clue that this is not a typical address for God. As these departed souls think about God, they use this word which describes supreme, absolute ownership. As Jeff indicated from his translation, it indicates sovereignty. When these people get a view of the afterlife, their view is, hey, who's really overall? God. Yes, it's true that those earthly powers were able to take our physical lives, but we're now kind of able to see the big picture. We have no doubt that God is the one who's in control, and he's going to take care of these folks. We don't know when, we'd like to know, but we do know the one who's in control. After people die, do you think there are any atheists?
No.
No. Not when they get to see. And these were the righteous folks. atheism, false philosophies, false religious philosophies terminate with this life, because after death, people really get an eyeful of what is going on. Anything you want to add or ask before we pick up with verse 11? Aaron, and then we'll take Stan's hand.
So are you suggesting that, like, the souls in the Hadean realm now have knowledge of Earth and the things are still going on Earth?
No.
They don't?
No.
Okay. So they know they're in the Hadean realm, but they know that they're not quite in heaven yet?
Right, and when you look at these fellas, if you're in the Hadean realm, you know that the judgment hasn't happened yet. You're waiting for that to happen. If the judgment hasn't happened yet, then what do you have on earth? These fellas are still there. They've not been dealt with. So you're waiting for, we're going to see this in Revelation chapter 7, and even at the end of chapter 6, this judgment by Christ at the end of time. You know, when's it going to happen? When are these people going to receive their due? And they're just sitting there, if you will, in the Hadean realm. Maybe not sitting literally, but they're waiting, they're resting there, waiting for this to occur. And it's one of the questions that these folks had.
People now, when they die, like the souls that are, like, if I were to die today, when I'm up there, I would have the same questions. Like, I would know. I mean, I would know that the judgment hasn't occurred yet, but
I would think that would be the same question that people would have today. How long? There are some things in my life that I'd like to see dealt with. There are some righteous people I'd like to be reunited with. There's some people. It would seem to me, based on Revelation chapter 6, that people are able to process various things in the Hadean realm. When we think back, and I didn't use this example because of who it was from, but if you think back in Luke 16, the unrighteous man. Remember that Abraham said to him, the rich man, "Son, remember the good things that you experienced in your lifetime." Now, to me, that seems to be more than sufficient evidence to say that the unrighteous people definitely have memories after death. Now, nothing is said about Lazarus there. It simply says he's comforted. But if the unrighteous would be able to have memories, I have to ask the question, why would righteous people also not be able to possess memories? When we look at Revelation chapter 6, if these people are in Hades, and it seems to me that conclusion is required based on the other evidence that we looked at from the scriptures, then certainly they too did have some memories. We have been unjustly punished. How long before this is dealt with? Now that does raise some other questions. Do you have any negative memories in eternity? Are you thinking about loved ones? Those are some questions that, to my knowledge, we simply can't answer. But we do know that this is a state that is referred to as paradise by Jesus, Luke 23:43. It is a great, great place to be. We think about Samuel in the Old Testament. When Saul wanted to call him up through the witch of Endor, he says, "Why have you disquieted me? Why have you disturbed me?" So whatever was going on there for Samuel, he found it to be a very, very pleasant state. But there does seem to be some questions that are not answered. Now, to me, I think you could probably go down that road and make a case for the idea that even though Hades is a perfect environment compared to this life, it's a great environment, it still doesn't answer all of our questions. We're going to have to be aware. In heaven, before everything is completely resolved. That's true from the standpoint of justice, and that also seems to be true from the standpoint of making sure that things are complete, full, entire for the peace of God's people. Anything else there? Okay, Stan, and then we'll take Don's hand.
Well, just a little clarification. God is timeless. Mm-hmm. We operate on time. But it seems like as we talk about Hades and we talk about heaven, we get closer and closer to God's realm. But if we continue to learn things and gain knowledge, as you're talking about, then it seems like time continues. Is time always going to be a part of our scenario or whatever? Is time going to be an issue in heaven when God doesn't know time or we're going to know time?
I don't know that I have the ability to process that question based on my current mental faculties. That would also be true, I think, for any individual. Because for us, when we think, you know, man obviously has a starting point. If we are eternal after we begin, that is, there is no ending point for us. You can argue, I guess, from one perspective that there is time because we did have a beginning point. We are not eternal in the sense. It's we had to have a starting point, but there is no termination point. Teresa, take your hand just a second. But in eternity, it just, you know, lasts and lasts and lasts. So if you can think about something that goes on and on and on and doesn't end, and you can somehow fit time into that definition, then I would say yes. We will have time in that particular sense. But from the other standpoint, if you're looking at it, that there will be no end. Because there will be no end, there's really no way to mark time. Then I would say no.
Well, what if we only have the perception of time? In other words, there is no time, but God gives us that perception of time, then time really doesn't have to exist if we just perceive that it is.
Yes. You know, we sing songs like that. When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, in that particular song, we express both concepts. We express the concept of time 10,000 years, but we also express the concept of eternality, because it'll be just like it started. There is, you know, you see somebody live for 10,000 years on the earth, which we don't, but I mean, were that to be true, they'd be old and wrinkled and probably, you know, on the last breath. But things are still going to be fresh and new and so forth. So there seems to be that duality from our perspective, and that's about the best that I think mankind can do with that right now, Stan. We just don't have the ability to process it. Trace? Okay.
I think time began Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created. That's when time began. And I think when he destroys the earth,
well, that's the key, as we know it.
But Hades is around, it has been since man was started dying. But anyway, so I think, does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, and there's the key, as we know it. But we do seem to have both of those concepts, that there's going to be that continued existence, but how, if at all, that's marked, we're simply not told. Don?
Well, back to your answer to error of judgment. It would seem to me that if you're in paradise, you already know the judgment. If you're in Hades, you already know, or if you're in hell,
you know if you're saved or lost at that point, yes.
I mean, Abraham knew that the rich man was not saved.
Right.
He could see him talk to me when Lazarus stood or not enough. It was, you know, a question would come up, if these saints that were martyred, if they were sitting there not knowing that the people had killed them, not in the other, across the chasm. If Abraham knew that the rich man was there, why wouldn't they know that their children were there?
Well, I think they did. When you look at the question,
they already knew that they were going to hell.
Yeah, but I think they probably did have that knowledge. But still, it's how long? That's the question. How long until this occurs?
Would that make any difference if they're already there?
Well, again, you know, I didn't frame the question. This was the question of these guys. Their question is how long? The timing is what... They don't seem to have any doubt that God's going to deal with these guys. But their question is how long? Or stated another way, when is this going to occur?
I think it's satisfaction now these people being avenged.
I wanted to say a little bit about that. Sometimes you find some people who will say, you know, they were bent on some bloodthirsty vengeance. To me, that's not what they say. They recognize that God is just. They recognize that God is going to deal with these folks. So it's not, God, go get them. But once again, if you go back and you look at the question, it's how long? Or when is this going to occur? We know what you're going to do, God. Can you tell us when it's going to occur? Give us the date, if you will. Give us the time. And God says, here's the answer, Revelation chapter 7. It's being delayed for a particular reason.
Isn't it kind of like you're wanting to know when justice will be served?
Right.
Basically.
Yeah.
It's not as far as vengeance go. It's just when is justice going to be served?
Yeah. It would be like today, a judge has sentenced someone and says, you're going to die by execution. There's no question, as the family members hear that judgment, there's no question about what's going to happen to the guy. But the judge doesn't specify when that's going to be. The family would then, you know, that lost a loved one due to this, murderer, the family then would logically be asking, when's that going to happen? We don't doubt what's going to occur because that decision has already been made. But when is that fellow going to be put to death? That would be parallel to here. So, thank you. Steve?
Well, I think we read it says until you, talking about God, judge. So first they're going to be judged, and then avenge, which that's the consequence for what they've done. But is this talking about Christians who were persecuted and were killed?
To me, that seems to be the right explanation. These fellows had lost their lives in some brutal way. We talked about that a little bit before. In especially in the first century world, some were tossed into the arena and eaten by lions. Other people were used for the gladiatorial games. Some were covered with pitch and used as human torches. Those were vicious ways to die. So these fellas, they were not bent on vengeance, but it was, hey, can you kind of give us a clue as far as what you have planned, the timing of it? And God says, you're going to have to wait. It's on a schedule. It's on a time plan that I'm going to operate by. And that's really what Jesus said in Matthew 24:36, isn't it? But of that day and hour, knoweth no man. Heaven's got it arranged. So even for the people after death, you're going to have to just hold your horses and wait. God's going to operate on his own time schedule. Bonnie?
Well, to me, this whole thing of the Hadean realm and all of that, I just have a real hard time comprehending this. And because we know that the judgment's not going to happen until the Lord returns. But when we die and we're in the Hadean realm, to me, like Don said, the judgment has already occurred because we're either going to be on one side or the other. We are going to be separated. We're not going to be with the righteous people. So my way I've always dealt with this is I don't worry about it. I worry about what I'm doing now, so I don't have to worry about it then. That's how I deal with it.
Sure, and that's fine. You think about Hebrews 9:27, it's appointed unto man once to die, after this, the judgment. There is that judgment. As far as if you are sent over here to the good side of Hades, that judgment has been made. If you're sent over to the bad side of Hades, once again, a judgment has been made. We maybe have, preachers have often talked about a day of judgment. It might be better to describe that as a day of sentencing. Because you have already, if you've been in the Hadean realm for a while, you will already know where you're headed. I mean, we should know before we die where we're headed. But if there's any doubt, that's sealed after death, Hebrews 9:27. And then you have there the picture in Matthew chapter 25. Come ye blessed of my Father. Well, they've been blessed for a long time in the Hadean realm. Depart ye cursed. They've already been cursed because of their time in the Hadean realm. So if you think about it, that may be one additional way to consider that there is that judgment, if you will, as soon as a person dies. But when Jesus returns, then people are going to be formally sentenced to here or there. All right, Revelation chapter 6, let's pick up with some information in verse 11. John records how these martyrs were told that they needed a rest. And rest for how long?
A little while longer.
A little while longer, a little time. Now for us, how long is a little while?
10 weeks.
Yeah, 10 minutes. We think a year, that's not a little time. For a small child, that's eternity. When we deal with the book of Revelation, though, we have some descriptions that sometimes are descriptions that we would not normally use. Here, I understand this resting for a little time. Think about what we're describing. If you're in the Hadean realm, when was this information written? About 2,000 years ago, wasn't it? All right. They're asking how long? How long before the Lord comes back, judges or sentences these people, to use what we talked about earlier? All right, he says a little time. Well, how much time has passed since John wrote this? About 2,000 years. Now, however God defines a little time, I don't know. But I know in this particular case, it includes at least 2,000 years or thereabouts. And maybe it's going to include another 5,000, 10,000, maybe another 50,000 years or longer. We're simply not told. But the expression, a little time, seems to describe the entire Christian age, from the day of Pentecost in Acts 2 all the way until the end of time. God has this plan. It's going to proceed on its own timetable. When we look at our society, though, Christians sometimes, they think, well, God, you should act, and you should act when? Now, you should act according to my time schedule. But God says you're just going to have to wait it out. So even in the afterlife, there are some people who still had some questions about God's timing. The other quick point I want to make here is that these people, they're being given really a yes answer that God is going to avenge, but it's going to be delayed. The expression fulfilled their course, if you have a footnote, it might say something like fulfilled in number. If you looked at the information that was passed out last week, this will kind of tie into that. My understanding of Revelation chapter 7, to kind of introduce you to this and let you start thinking about it, is that when the Lord returns, there will not be left on the earth a single person who, if allowed to live their natural course, would become a Christian. In other words, can you think of something that we would say it would be like, fishing a tank, and you would say, or maybe like working a mine, and you would say, we've mined out all the gold, and there's nothing left. We've taken out the last ounce of gold. Can you think about something that would be dealt with so thoroughly that there's nothing left to get? You've gleaned it all. Well, I guess you could have that with the bean crop, couldn't you? You've got a row of beans, and it's time to harvest the beans, and you go and you pick all the plants clean. There is literally nothing left. You've stripped them all of their beans. And no matter how many times you go back and you look, there's nothing left in the row of beans. My understanding of Revelation chapter 7 is that that's going to be the state of things when the Lord returns. And that's tied in here with fulfilled the course, or as the footnote says, fulfilled the number. There will not be a single person when Jesus returns living on the earth that if they were allowed to continue to live, that at some point they would become a Christian. God has literally harvested every soul. If you think back to Revelation chapter 6, verse 2, remember, and I saw, and behold, a white horse. He that sat thereon had a bow. There was given unto him a crown, and what did he do? He went forth to conquer. What do we say about the conquering? What's Jesus doing? He's reaping. He's out there conquering sin. He's bringing people into a spiritual kingdom. Well, we're getting to the point where John's going to develop this particular point again. A couple of the quick points, and then we'll pick up with Revelation chapter 6, verses 12 through 7. We've talked about the white robes before. I've suggested that in heaven, I don't know if people are going to be wearing clothing or not, but the idea of white robes in heaven, I'm not sold on that idea for a lot of reasons, one of which is found in Revelation chapter 19, verse 8. In 19:8 it says, "And it was given unto her that she should array herself in fine linen, bright and pure, for the fine linen is the what?
Righteous
acts of the saints." Now here you have a reference to clothing, but John says, I want you to know that this clothing is not literal. This clothing stands for something. What's it represent? The righteous acts. Well, to me, we seem to have that same connotation with the white robe. Not literally. Well, it could be literal, but I think here the emphasis, since we have so much symbolic language in the book, you have a white robe. Well, what does that represent?
Purity.
Our purity. When we become a Christian, we get our white robe. John talked about that back in Revelation chapter 3. Verse 4, as we go into eternity, are we still going to have our white robe? Are we not going to be righteous in eternity?
Yeah.
We are. The Bible says that nothing impure can come before God. So we have to be in that righteous, that cleansed, that freed state of sin. When we look at this fifth seal, the souls under the altar, it tells us that God knows exactly what His people experience as they live for Him on the earth. It also tells us that Christians, if they will prevail, if they will persist in living the Christian life, they will be okay. But 6:11 says, if you live faithfully for God, might you die for your faith? Yeah, be prepared for that. Be prepared to suffer whatever is necessary to be a Christian, and it's all going to work out in the end. Anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up with 6:12 through 17?
Well, that was a good encouraging statement to make, that it all work out in the end.
That's one of the great themes that we see expressed in different ways throughout the book of Revelation, and it is one of the most encouraging books to study when God's people are going through a difficult time. Even if we can't always successfully sort out all the symbolism in a class or on our own, we can get the big picture. And it is a book, in my mind, that should be read by Christians at least once a year. Okay, Revelation 6, 12 to 17. And I saw, when he opened the sixth seal, remember there are seven seals. This is number six. Seal seven is not going to be introduced until Revelation 8. And when he opened the sixth seal, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the whole moon became as blood. and the stars of the heaven fell unto the earth, as a fig tree casteth her unripe figs when she's shaken of a great wind. And the heaven was removed as a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island were removed out of their places. And the kings of the earth, and the princes, and the chief captains, and the rich, and the strong, and every bondman and freeman, hid themselves in the caves and in the rocks of the mountains. And they say to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath is come, and who is able to stand? These verses go back to a lot of imagery that we find in the Old Testament. You would find similar imagery, for example, back in Isaiah chapter 13, verses 1 and 10. Let's head somebody back there. You'll have a couple of minutes to find it. Isaiah chapter 13, verses 1 and 10. Who wants to take that? Okay, Jeff. Matthew 24:29, when Jesus talked about the destruction of Jerusalem, you have the same thing there. When we go back and we look at Matthew 24 or some of the Old Testament passages like Isaiah 13, we find that this imagery is used to describe not literal stuff, but just like the white robes. It is used time and time again to describe the overthrow of a secular nation, whether that would be Egypt, Babylon, Assyria, all kinds of human powers. Isaiah 13, verses 1 and 10, Jeff.
The oracle concerning Babylon.
Okay, there it is. What is he talking about? Babylon, a physical nation on earth. Okay, let's skip down to verse 10. We've introduced who we're talking about.
For the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising, and the moon will not shed its light.
Okay, this is the same imagery that we have in Revelation chapter 6. But when we go back and study Isaiah chapter 13, God used images like the sun and the moon going dark and the stars falling to say, hey, this nation is going to do what? It's going to collapse. It's going to fall. This nation is going to be overthrown. If you do not know that the Old Testament uses this kind of imagery to describe the overthrow of a nation, then when you come to this verse today, what are you thinking? The kind of information in Revelation chapter 6 sounds like, well, we've got meteors and we've got nuclear, war and all kinds of crazy stuff. But the Old Testament helps us understand that we're talking about the overthrow of civil government. This sixth seal really takes us up to the end of time. Remember seal 5, the people were asking, what question? How long? We know that there are wicked people on the earth. Look to those rulers that did all these terrible things to us. God, how long are you going to allow wicked people to persevere? Now as we come to the sixth signal, the sixth seal, God says what? Hey, a time is coming when these nations, Rome or whoever, they will be overthrown. They are going to be brought down. And God says, when this time comes, I want to tell you, I want to share with you what this justice is ultimately going to be like. John uses, you could count them up, Revelation chapter 6, where does he talk about? Verse 15. The groups there. Anybody want to guess how many numbers? If you number the groups there, how many you find? You probably find 7, and you do. You think John just decided, well, let's just come up with 7. No. 7 symbolizes what? Completeness, perfection, fullness. So when John says some people are going to be overthrown, he uses the number 7 to symbolize what? Every human power. Every human authority. Every human government is going to be brought low or overcome when Jesus returns at the end of time. Here's the point. If we put our faith in a government or in a group of people, how successful are we going to be? We're going to fail. That might help us in this life, but it's not going to help us in eternity. Because Revelation 6 says all the governments, all the plans, all the programs that they have, one day it's going to be overthrown. Our faith needs to be in the kingdom that cannot be shaken. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 28. John in verse 12 talks about this great earthquake. When we think about a big earthquake, you think that's going to shake things up? It will. What about when the Lord returns? Is that going to take some things in a brand new direction? It will. It's going to shake things up big time. He talks about the sun becoming black as sackcloth. Is life dependent on the sun? Physical life?
Yes.
All right, we take the sun away, we're going to die. When he talks about the sun going black, it's not just an eclipse, but he's actually talking about, removing it. Once again, a way of describing the end's going to come, The stuff that we now know to exist is going to disappear. All the earthly powers are going to be made low. They're going to be brought down. The moon turning to blood, once again emphasizing the change is going to take place. Verse 13, the stars of the heaven, that would be the rulers. They're going to be, you know, removed. The fig tree that loses its figs when they're unripe, due to what?
Mighty wind.
Now, we've seen crops. You see the apples on the trees, and they get ripe, and after they get ripe, what happens to them? The fall. But if you have those apples early in the year, what's it going to take to get them off the tree? It's going to take some pretty strong wind to shake those from the tree. They're going to have to really be knocked around quite a bit. John uses that imagery as well to say, hey, this time is coming when the Lord is going to return, and it's going to be great upheaval. It's going to really shift. It's really going to change things. There will be no nation. There will be no group of people. There will be no individual that will have the power to withstand the Lord at his next and final coming. Then we have the scroll in verse 14. This is what people use to write on in this particular day and time. When we're through with our papers, what do we do with them today? We put them away. Okay, sign them, do what's necessary, and put them away. All right, he compares the earth to a scroll. When God is through with the earth, what's he going to do with it? Just like that scroll's put away with the earth, he's going to say, your time is up, time is over, and one day the heaven is going to be removed because the time for man to live on the earth is going to be over. The mountains in this verse, when we look at the Old Testament, we don't have time for it, but Isaiah 41, verse 15, you would find there that God's enemies are, throughout the Old Testament, sometimes described as mountains. Figuratively speaking, you know, mountain is literally an enemy of God, but when we think about mountains, they're big, they're powerful, such as we would think of God's enemies sometimes being. Then you have the idea of an island. An island would also represent leaders. And in this particular case, when we think about an island, do we have any islands in our county? No. Got to go probably at least a state over to get to an island. So it may refer to not only leaders, but maybe distant leaders. Leaders far away. But God says even they are not going to be able to withstand the Lord when he returns. The displacement of the island shows that all things are going to be destroyed. It reminds me a little bit of Hebrews chapter 1, verses 10 through 12. Remember, the Hebrew writer says, as a mantle, speaking of the heavens and the earth. He said, what are you going to do? You're going to, as a scroll, you're going to roll them up. He promises that the end of the world will one day come and God's going to make all this stuff disappear. Then as you look at the seven classes in verse 15, all the people who've ever lived were focused on the unrighteous right now will one day stand before God. And as these people stand before God, do you think that they're going to fear? The kings of the earth, the princes, the chief captains, the rich, the strong, the mighty, the bondmen, and the free, you think they're going to be afraid when the Lord comes back?
I don't think so.
They're going to be terrified. John describes it. As you look at the end of 15, he says they hide themselves in the caves and in the rocks and in the mountains. Now, will that literally be possible when the Lord comes? Run off to a cave somewhere? No. So, as we see with other figurative language in the book, he's not saying that there's going to be some cave that people can hide to. But they're going to be just like people today. When you find someone, maybe a person who's been picked up for a crime, he's being interrogated. What do you see if you've ever watched a cop show? He'll say anything to get out of the set of circumstances, won't he? He'll lie through his teeth. If he can run from the cops, he will do whatever he can do. But sometimes, there's nothing you can do. Sometimes you're confined and you're just stuck. But you would do these things if you could. This is John's illustration of the second coming. The people are going to be so terrified, they will do whatever they could to somehow avoid the Lord. It's imagery that's also based on the Old Testament as far as the caves and the rocks, Isaiah 2, verses 10, 19, and 21, but it's simply not going to work. Remember Adam and Eve, after they ate the forbidden fruit, Genesis 3, 8, what did they do? Try to hide themselves from God. But can you hide from God? No. The same thing's going to be true at the second coming. People will want to escape from Christ, but it simply will not be possible. We know the earth is going to be destroyed. 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 through 12. The Lord's return will be so fast, it's like the blink of an eye. 1 Corinthians 15, 52. So people will not be able to find any kind of hiding place. Then as you look at verse 16 again, they say to the mountains and the rocks, do what?
Fall
on us. Can you imagine a person who is so desperate that would say, I want this rock to fall on me and crush me.
Well, he says fall on us and hide us. So keep us alive and just hide us from God, seems like to me.
Yeah. But you've got to, yeah, you can probably make both things come from there. Hiding, and if you can't hide from God, you think you want to die? Nobody wants to face him. So, an extreme picture of what it's going to be like. At some future time, when the Lord returns, the unsaved, verse 17, will realize the great day of their wrath has come. This is going to be the judgment day. And John asks the question in 17, for the great day of wrath has come. What's the question at the end of the verse? Who is able to stand? Now, this is a great question. Revelation 7 is used to answer this question. Who can stand when the Lord returns? In Revelation 7, John says, let me tell you who this is going to be. As we mentioned, Revelation chapter 8 is going to deal with the final seal. That's going to wrap it up for me. Anything that you want to add or ask quickly before we shut it down today? Steve?
Does any of this refer to...